If you like hearing about basic concepts like IV fluid or more advanced things, then beyond this podcast, you also might really like the Intensive Care Academy. That's our other project, which is video-based and offered to subscribers over at ICU101.com. Brian and I have tons of content on all kinds of topics, including lots of videos and even a couple of additional podcast feeds available only to you there. Check it out if you haven't, ICU101.com. On to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Brandon, what's up?
Oh, you know, I'm thriving in this new world. We are without a guest today. We're trying to get back to some nice kind of basics for all those of you who thrive on your meat and potatoes. And we realized that we haven't really had an episode where we drilled down on the topic of IV fluids. I mean, we've certainly talked about this in some other settings, but kind of as a one-stop shop for how we manage this, you know, our favorite ICU drug. Although a little less so nowadays. So we thought we'd just chat about how we kind of, our general mindset when it comes to fluids, how we choose them, how much to use, when to, when not to, that kind of thing. Certainly, you know, I think it's fair to say that a lot of us are using them less these days. I mean, there was a time when it was like, if you arrive in the ICU, it's just a healthful thing to be floated away. You got to swell to get well and then pee to be free, they would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you learn the like formula for how to calculate, you know, what fluids every patient should be on?
What's that?
I don't remember it. I don't ever use it, but I remember learning in school, like there was this formula, like every patient should be on maintenance fluids and this is how to calculate them. And, I don't remember.
Yeah. It was like an expected thing at some point for like everyone. And then especially in the ICU, just like fluids seem better than everything else. So
yeah.
I think we're a little more aware of the risks, but you know, we don't want to overstate it. These pendulums swing and they are, you know, you could harm people by not giving enough fluids for sure. So,
sure.
So let's just talk about some practical things. One of our favorite things to do in the, you know, sick patient is to give them boluses of fluid. There's a lot that's been said about deciding, you know, which patient is fluid responsive and might benefit from an additional preload. But on just a practical level, let's say you're thinking, you know, this patient, they might be volume responsive. They might benefit from a little bit more preload. How do you actually do it? Like, what's your typical volume of a bolus of fluid?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So I think it probably depends a little bit on the patient. And their sort of overall status. So if I have somebody who is, you know, otherwise fairly healthy person who has a good, strong heart, no lung problems, et cetera, I'm probably going to give a liter. I have given 500 before just for folks who, you know, I'm a little worried about, just sort of as a test dose. And you can, I mean, you can give 250, but to me, 250 just doesn't seem like it's going to be enough to really tell. If it's going to make a difference or not.
Well, because you're saying two things. One is, you know, what's the right dose to treat? But there's also like a diagnostic question. It's often up in the air. Are they actually going to be fluid responsive? So this is actually a bit of a challenge. You want to see, and again, a bigger topic, how you're going to assess that. A lot of people on a practical level, it might just be, does their blood pressure go up? But maybe you're doing things with echo or urine or whatever. But yeah, the smaller the amount, the less the challenge, right? If I'm going really small, it's, I think, all the more important to give it really fast. Because if you give 250 over like an hour, no one's going to see what that does.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I think that's the other key to a bolus is it has to be a bolus, right? You know, and I've seen people give, quote unquote, a bolus, like a liter over 2 hours. That's not a bolus. That's maintenance fluid. You know, and I remember hearing, I forget who it was, one of the other podcasters a couple of years ago talking about this and saying, you know, if you're going to give a bolus, you got to give a bolus. And they were actually saying a bolus should be on a pressure bag, not even on the 999 pump, but just pressure bag it in because it needs to get in fast so you can see if there's a change.
Yeah, and so if people who are not aware of this, typically the IV pumps you'll usually see, you know, these things will drive fluid. They don't just limit the rate of it. So they can push it in, but the maximum rate everywhere I've seen in this country is 1 liter per hour. So 999 cc's per kilo, which means that's the fastest you could bolus using the pump. And that's not very fast. I mean, one liter over an hour, most people as kind of a default definition, they would probably say a bolus is like under 15 minutes probably. And now if you're going to give 250 at 999, that is in 15 minutes. So it is something.
The volume is dependent too. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean a true bolus as like a, if you really actually want it to be a bolus, I would assume you usually need to put it under pressure, which is more work. Because it's nice to put it on a pump, you dial in the amount, and then that's it. They have to find a pressure bag and that sort of thing. And then if it's like a small amount, then they have to watch it so it doesn't squeeze in the whole liter or whatever. It's more work for nursing, but it's sort of always more real.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on kind of what your goal is too. Like if you just think somebody's a little dry and you think, well, they just need a little bit of pumping up, I think a liter over an hour is probably fine. It's going to get them hydrated. But it's not going to like resuscitate them. So if you've got somebody who's hypotensive, for example, and you're like, I need to give them some fluid to get their hypotension resolved, then you probably do need to give it faster. But if you get somebody who's just got anemic urine output, like their urine output's like meh, you know, and you look at their labs and you go, oh, they look a little dry. So let's just give them some fluid and see if their urine output picks up. A liter over an hour is probably fine.
Yeah, it's really a matter of what your goal is. The patient who is like acutely in shock and you think they're hypovolemic and you want to increase their intravascular volume by as much as possible, as quickly as possible, you got to get in as quickly as possible because you know that isotonic crystalloids have a pretty high volume of distribution. A lot of it's going to leak out of the vasculature pretty quickly. And if you're putting it in slower than it's leaking out, you're going to have very little effect.
Right.
So, you know, within whatever, an hour, you're probably going to lose 3/4 of that to the extravascular space. So it's a question of, is that okay? In the patient who's acutely in shock, probably not. You want to get as much of it in acutely as you can, understanding that it will still leak out. But for at least for a little while, you're getting the maximal effect until it settles to that equilibrium. In the patient, like you said, who is not really that acute, and you're just trying to kind of overall increase their total body volume a little, then fine, give it over now, or even slower. People will do these kind of in between a bolus and a drip where you're like, you know, give it like 250 or half a liter over like a couple, 3 hours. That's often you can't even order it as a bolus. You got to order it as a drip and set like an end time on it.
What's funny, in our Epic order set, there's an order for bolus, and you open it up and it gives you the option of normal saline or LR. That's it, right? You want to bolus anything else, you got to do it a fancy different way. But if you pick, and I can't remember which one it is. If you pick one, the default is over 15 minutes, for whatever volume you pick. The other one, the default is over 2 hours. And I don't know why, because it's in the same order set. The only difference is like normal saline, we want to get in really fast. LR, we want to get in slow, or vice versa. Like I said, I can't remember. But it's always just obnoxious to me that it's
always a good caveat to that. Like the people who make your orders, they probably gave some thought to what the little default buttons are, but that doesn't mean that it's like right.
Yeah. And in fact, that one that's default over 2 hours or whatever, the little, it's got buttons. Those of you who don't know Epic or don't know what we're talking about, right? They have a blank space where you can type it in, but there's also buttons if you just want to quick select.
It's like the common helpful thing.
Yeah. And it's like you said, whoever sets it up picks whatever the common helpful ones are. And it's like 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hour. The other one is 15 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours. Why? I don't know.
Yeah, I remember that the people who made these, it probably was ideal for some setting, but it's often not the ICU. Like ours, prednisone, like the most common dose we probably give is 40 milligrams a day for stuff like COPD. It's not one of the buttons. So I really think approaching this with and this applies to a lot of things, you know, having a bit of a gestalt pretest probability for like how much fluid you think this person is likely to need. And also, you know, how much risk and harm there is likely to be, because you can kind of approach it from both sides. The patient where there's not a lot of chance of harm, you know, younger patients, good hearts, good kidneys, this is like the trauma patient and stuff. they still may or may not need more fluid, but it's also probably safe to like go hog on them. So, you know, SICUs, surgical trauma kinds of settings like you primarily work in, you tend to see larger boluses because yep. it's generally both safer and they're a little more likely to need it because they're more likely to be hypovolemic. Medical settings, there's usually both more risk, patients who are not as tolerant of fluid, and they're just not as likely to need it. There's not that many severely hypovolemic MICU right. patients.
And they're pretty obvious when they are. Right,
yeah. The DKA patient.
Right.
If you're giving large boluses to medical patients, I would really have a pause of what you think you're treating because it's either probably too much. You're getting like liters to these people or they're like bleeding. You know, that's
right.
true hemorrhagic shock. But then maybe fluid is not the treatment. You know,
right,
you want
exactly.
to get blood or something.
Well, it is fluid, but it's the red fluid.
Yeah. So, yeah, liter is kind of probably the upper end of what anyone do. And again, the old days, that was probably the default. Many times I'll go smaller. But again, if you're going smaller, think about giving fast. You can give more small boluses. So that's always good. But it is like there's a practical thing of neither you or the nurse is going to want to give like 8 250cc boluses
right,
over
right.
a couple hours. So,
yeah, no, I will do sometimes like that. Like, let's give 500 and as fast as you can get it in and see what happens. And if they respond to it, give the other five, right? You've got a liter bag up maybe. And so just give half and then give the other half.
Yeah. And you know, in the right setting, you can do it much more finite. Like if, you know, some of the surgery patients where you have like a cordis and like an A-line, you can be at a really effective sense for their fluid responsiveness because you can blast in 250cc's in like 20 seconds and
yeah.
see what it does to their blood pressure, which again, I think is practically often the metric people will use. It's just a pain in the butt to look at other things. Are you really going to be in there looking at the LVOT VTI every 15 minutes or whatever?
Right, right.
Probably not.
Right. Well, that's the other thing I think that limits the speed at which you can give a bolus is what kind of access do you have? Right. If you've got somebody who, like you said, has a big cordis and reducer, a hog line, something like that, you can get volume in them pretty quick. If you're dealing with somebody who has a PICC line, not so much. And even worse, if you have just sort of some flimsy small gauge peripherals, they're just going to blow. And so that's one reason that I tend to, if I have somebody who I think is going to need a lot of volume resuscitation, I'll just go ahead and put a big line in them preemptively so that if we get to that point, we're set up to give big boluses.
Yeah, there's nothing more frustrating than trying to give like true volume resuscitation to someone through some teeny weeny yeah. lines.
But. And we should remind people, since this, if there's newer people listening, that a triple lumen is not a resuscitation line. Right, 7-French triple lumen is horrible for this. You're much better off with large gauge, even 18s, but ideally 16 or 14 peripherals than a triple lumen because
yeah, it's reliable.
It's
but
reliable,
it's slow.
But it's super slow. Yeah.
Usually the lumens in there are like maybe 2 18s and a 16 or something, and that would be pretty big peripherally, but it's a much longer line.
It's longer, right? And so yeah. you have to remember that the flow rate is. I can't remember the ratio, but it's affected by the length.
I believe that's the law of Poisson.
Yeah, Poisson.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, if you really want to maximize it, use the largest lumen, which is the distal one, the
yeah.
brown port, and take off any caps or claves that are in the way, which also really limit flow. And, of course, pressure. Pressure makes an exponential difference in max flow rates through any access. So you're putting through a smaller IV or central line, an IO. Pressure is key.
Yeah.
I think the other thing to just bear in mind when you're talking about, you know, fluid for shock is that whether or not you can technically get a response doesn't necessarily mean that the risk is always outweighing the benefit. There's
yeah.
just not that big of a window for like healing people in shock if it's not from something like hemorrhage with fluid. You know, we talked with John Emil Kemi a few months ago about kind of assessing, you know, the both sides of that risk and benefit. And it's just we know that there is risk the more volume you basically put into the bodies of critically ill patients. And just think about that relatively transient benefit you're usually getting from boluses. And especially when you're like, you know, you have like the floor patient whose pressure is soft and you're like, oh, do we need the ICU and pressors? Oh, maybe we can do more boluses and stuff. I mean, whether or not you may be able to get by with such things is maybe a separate question from, is this patient better off just like putting unnecessary volume into their body for this like small transient effect. You know, at what point are you doing just the wrong thing?
Yeah, I think we say fluid responsive a lot when what we should be asking is fluid beneficial, right? Because like you said, just because someone responds to fluid doesn't mean that it's the right thing to do, that it's going to benefit them or benefit them to the degree that it outweighs the downsides.
Yeah. Okay. Which fluid?
LR.
Yeah. There's this ongoing debate about balanced fluids versus, you know, unbalanced or high chloride ones. It's usually normal saline is like not balanced because it's way too much chloride relatively. And balanced ones are usually LR, although there is plasmalite, things like that, which a little less commonly seen, but same idea. It's just got a buffer in it, which is, you know, takes the place of bicarb, which you can't usually put in plastic bags on the shelf. It doesn't stay there. They have to mix bicarb solutions from glass. So if you want to just pull something down and bolus it, it's got something like lactate in it. But
yeah, so I say LR as my knee-jerk reaction. I don't know that it matters all that much. I've seen studies that have shown that until you get into a lot of volume, that there's not a whole lot of difference. So I think if you're in a pinch and you need some fluid and you've got saline hanging in the room, bolus the saline.
Right.
If you if you've got time to go get LR, then go get the LR. And I think this is somewhat dependent too on your patient and your goals. When I'm in the neuro ICU, I tend to bolus with normal saline because one of my goals there is typically to keep their saline or their sodium on the high side. And so why not? But in the surgical ICU, I tend to do LR.
Yeah, it's again been an ongoing thing in the literature, whether balanced solutions are a little bit healthier or better for the kidneys. By and large, it's like not been a consistent or impressive signal, but no one really has a case that these weird unbalanced solutions like saline are better. So if you have both, it's kind of like, why not use something balanced?
Yeah.
But, you know, if you don't, then fine. Yeah, if it's more expensive or less available, and that used to be more often the case, I think nowadays most places have both. But I wouldn't like be like, oh, no, not the saline.
Right. Yeah, and that's what I'll say a lot of times is I have a patient who comes up from IR, let's say, right? They've had a procedure or the OR. And their pressure's a little soft, and they don't have any pressors going. And you know, the nurse is like, "Hey, their MAP's falling," and I just give them a bolus. What do you want? What do you got?
Whatever you got there. Yeah.
I see there's a bag of something hanging. Just run that in.
Yeah.
And I don't think it really matters. I think a lot of the studies that we're seeing where it matters, where you get like hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis and stuff, you're talking about giving lots of fluid, which we just don't do that much anymore. And if you're giving that much fluid, you probably need to be doing something else.
Yeah, if you give 20 liters of saline, you will do some weird stuff.
Yeah.
But mostly we're in a smaller realm here.
Yeah.
Now, we say anything. We're talking about LR or saline. Probably don't bolus D5 containing fluids. You're going to really spike their sugar.
Right.
And probably don't try to use less than isotonic things, half normal D5W, because then they have a really large volume of distribution. You're getting very little intravascular effect.
Yeah. Those do have their place, but not for this.
Yeah. Do you ever bolus hypertonic fluids for volume resuscitation? I mean, usually we use them for neuro things.
Yeah, but, as I say, I use them for brain resuscitation, but not really for volume. No.
There's talk of that
I have seen that, especially
the trauma military world, because you bolus, you know, 250 cc's of 3%, you get the intravascular effect of, you know, almost a liter. It's like the opposite volume distribution, but hasn't super duper caught on in a lot of the civilian world.
And I think, you know, it's one of those things that sort of logically makes sense. It's sort of like when we used to, and I say used to in quotes because we still do this in some patients, bolus colloids, right? Albumin for patients for volume. You know, I grew up in a world where in cardiac surgery, patients got albumin around the clock. We even would give things like Hetastarch, which before we found out that that's real bad for you and we stopped doing it. But for the same reason, right? Because there's more stuff in the fluid. So theoretically it all stays or more stays intravascularly. And you get more kind of bang for your buck, so to speak. You know, I think we still bolus albumin a lot in post liver transplant patients, but not a lot in other places. I don't know what they're doing in hearts these days because I don't do cardiac surgery patients anymore. That used to be a real go-to with that population too.
Yeah, albumin is another controversial area. Mm-hmm. I do think the hypertonic thing may have some legs. I mean, there's some talk that it has some positive effects on the glycocalyx and stuff. And, you know, sometimes the military likes it for practical reasons. Like if you have your fluids in a backpack for a medic and
right.
you can have like it's a very small volume to carry and stuff like that. But, okay. What about maintenance fluids? This is sort of a different realm, right? So I guess the obvious question is, when do you even think a patient needs to be on, quote, maintenance fluids? The idea being that they need some volume, some fluid in their body, which they're maybe not getting in another way, so you should put them on a continuous drip to provide it.
Almost never.
Yeah, that's kind of a weird thing to even
say.
Who would need that? I don't need
that. And now I will say that with a star, right? Because I do acknowledge that I work in very specialized environments. And so in the surgical ICU, in the neuro ICU, almost never. Like you said, I don't sit around consuming fluids all day and I'm okay. Now I'm not critically ill either, but I do consume fluids in a way that is analogous to how we do it in the ICU, which is through boluses, right? When I'm thirsty, I get a bottle of water and I drink the bottle of water. So I think that for the most part, you can do that in your ICU patients as well. If they look like they need some fluid, give them some fluid. And this is where, like I said, I think giving them a liter over an hour or even two is probably fine, right? You're not resuscitating them. They just look dry. So you're just going to tank them up, hydrate them a little bit. But they don't need maintenance fluids.
Yeah. And in that case, I guess you could say, well, why not give that fluid over, you know, stretched out over the day or something? But then you could say, well, why? I mean,
why?
If it's just as good either way, I would say it's probably better to not have a drip running because drips are just kind of a pain. I mean, it's one more thing to maintain, one more thing tied to the patient. It's probably some more cost. It's probably a more steady state. I mean, if that matters to you, but if you're just talking kind of maintenance, it may not matter. Mm. Now, but again, who even needs it? Remember two things: that patients who are eating or being fed are probably being hydrated the normal way through their gut. And even those who are not, a lot of them are still getting fluids. We give a lot of medications and IV fluids, either continuous drips or intermittent things. So if you're like, oh, this patient, let's say they've been NPO. That's a common thing, right?
Right.
Look at just their like fluid balance and how much they're getting regardless. Because many times you'll see, oh, they're getting like 150 cc's an hour of other stuff. And then you get to the end of the day and it's like a liter and a half, 2 liters of fluid already. And to start with, they already may be probably fluid overloaded. So now the patient who comes in dry and is NPO and stuff, it's not impossible. They could need more fluid, but the common ICU patient is getting fluids.
Yeah, some of our ICU patients are getting a couple of hundred in antibiotics alone.
Yeah.
Right? If you've got somebody on vancomycin, you're probably already getting, you know, a couple hundred, if not a liter a day in IV fluid just from those. Forget about on top of it, maybe they have a little bit of pressor running, they have some sedation running, all that stuff's in fluid. But yeah, I do think there are some people that you can make the case for, and it typically is extremes, right? So the other thing I think is if you're feeding the gut early enough and appropriately enough, then they should be getting plenty of fluid through that, right? Whether it's free water in addition to their tube feeds or their fluid that the tube feed is just going through. Now that's presuming people aren't just eating a regular diet. So I think one of the times that we see this is people who can't be fed enterally for an extended period of time, right? They have some sort of surgical complication or whatever.
Bowel obstruction.
Yeah, I see this a lot in my surgical oncology patients. But those folks, they tend to get some sort of parenteral nutrition pretty quick, right? So if the surgeon people have done a big, you know, rearrangement of the entire abdomen and they go, well, we're not going to be able to use the gut for days. They'll go ahead and start them on TPN. Now we can debate that. TPN has a whole host of other risks involved too, but if they need nutrition to heal and they can't use their gut and they're not going to be able to use their gut for an extended period of time, TPN probably is the way to go. You know, I have seen people who say, well, they just need some glucose. So let's just put them on like D5 half normal with some electrolytes thrown in, at like, you know, 48, that seems to be a weird surgical number that they like, an hour for a couple of days until we can use their gut again. But I don't know that that's really necessary.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the blood versus fluid thing. There's probably not a huge in-betweeny window between not needing anything and needing stuff enough that maybe that person should just be on, like, TPN. Mm-hmm. And there was this old thing that, oh, when you're going to be on PO for a while, getting some dextrose-containing fluids helps spare some protein loss and stuff. And, I think this applies to a lot of the critical care debates these days. There's probably some, like, there's some spectrum where things do matter, but the whole reason that it's in so much debate is because it probably doesn't matter all that much.
Right.
So like when something doesn't matter all that much, like maybe just don't do as much weird stuff to people. Cause then there's no risk for iatrogenesis, and continuous drips are always a little bit risky because they're so easy to forget about. These drips just run in the background. You don't even notice or remember them. And every hour they're getting more fluid and you don't even you end up with like diuresing people, not remembering that they're on a drip. So like that is another argument for it's doing something intentional like boluses, if that's what you're into, because then at least you know you gave it because you gave it and you gave it for a reason.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of intentionality when we do stuff to people, because like you said, if you're just putting in anything like that, it's easy to forget it. And then it applies to, you know, fluids, serial labs, right? How many times have you come in and the nurses are like, do we really need these Q2 blood gases still? And somebody's been getting Q2 blood gases for days because people just forgot they were ordered. And, you know, the results keep popping up, but there's so much signal to noise that you just forget about it. You know, and we know that hypervolemia is really bad for people. Lots of complications from it. And, you know, I was taught kind of early on in my career that if you're not negative, you're positive. And that's true, because if you're not actively making people negative, it will just make them positive, right? It just accumulates.
Yeah. It's a little like, choosing sedation or analgesia that's continuous drips versus PRNs, boluses.
Yeah.
I mean, on paper, if you were like a robot, it would make a lot of sense in a lot of cases to do more continuous things because of a more steady state need. But on a practical level, you end up often giving too much because anything that's continuous is passive and then it goes whether you need it or not. Whereas if you intentionally give something, it's usually only for a reason. So there's always kind of a give or take here. But, you know, you can mitigate the risk by setting end times on things, having them expire. So you have to intentionally, you know, restart it if needed. Those can be good strategies. But again, I'm not saying don't give maintenance fluids, but anytime you do it, just really think like, is this really helping us much? You know, how much bang for our buck is there? The times when I think more are, I know maybe they're not going to eat for a while. Maybe they're starting out on the dry side and maybe there are ongoing like outputs that are significant. You know, the patient who is having high output from like a OG tube, you know, or they're having a lot of diarrhea or, you know, sometimes, you know, like a burn patient would be a classic. They're just super oozy and there's fluids going into the bed and stuff like that. Again, the bleeding patient is a different story. Don't try to just fill them up with those fluids. But
but, you know, like our colorectal guys, for example, talk about high output fistulas, you know, they lose a lot of volume. They will often put them on a little bit of maintenance fluid, like maybe, you know, like I said, 24, 48 an hour, but then do one-to-one replacement. So if they lose 100 this hour, then they get a bolus of 100 this hour or so forth. And that's probably not a good example because 100 is probably not significant. But, you know, the post-op kidney transplants get one-to-one urine replacement. So if they put 250 of urine out, then they get a 250 bolus back. To replace those fluids. And I think that's probably a better strategy than just set it and forget it maintenance fluid. Now, one of the other times that I will put maintenance fluid on people is somebody who's persistently hypoglycemic and NPO, right? Every time they do a finger stick, they're having to give them, you know, an amp or half an amp of D50. You just put them on some D5 or D10 and it probably fixes that. But again, you kind of watch. I tend to go with D10 because I can give them more sugar for less volume. And so if they just need a little bit, then I can put it on a real low rate and they just get the sugar, but without getting too overloaded.
Yeah. D10, T20, higher concentrations let you kind of give them the sugar you want to without also necessarily giving them a bunch of fluid. And that's, something we could also ask, like, when do you give a fluid that contains dextrose, which usually is kind of something you can add to whatever. You can give D5, W, D5, normal saline, D5, LR, D5, lower content. I mean, depends what you have versus what your pharmacy can mix up. But, you know, in those cases where it's prolonged and they're not getting nutrition, it's usually, I think, reasonable to add dextrose. But again, in the end, I don't think it matters all that much. I think there's very few patients where it made some colossal difference whether you added D5 to their fluids, with the exception of the one who is persistently truly hypoglycemic, in some niche cases like DKA, right? Some things where you're specifically driving down the glucose and you need to support it by putting it back into them. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a different matter, but that's not the typical patient.
Right, but I think, like you said, in DKA, you're specifically targeting something, right? You're not just giving them fluid, you are resuscitating them, and you're resuscitating their sugar as well.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the general themes for this, as well as a lot of our current state of critical care. Try to do things for a reason, not just because it sort of seems like good, like the chicken soup approach, like, this can't hurt, you know, why not? Like, because most of that stuff doesn't seem like it actually matters that much. I mean, that's the theme of the evidence. And again, if it doesn't matter, it's probably not good. It costs more, it's more burden on everyone, and everything seems like it has risks that we don't appreciate very well. So if you don't need it, just don't do it. The kind of minimalist approach. What do you think about bicarb containing drips? When do you turn to that?
Really only when I've got somebody who has persistently low bicarb that's affecting their pH and causing other problems, right? If I've got somebody who's, we see this a lot with patients who have chronic renal failure, kidney transplants, liver transplants have a lot of chronic renal failure. A lot of just our surgery patients have a lot of chronic renal failure.
Yeah. You need your kidneys to make your own bicarb.
Yeah. And, and their bicarb will be 14, 16, something like that. But their pH will be normal. It's just their bicarb's deranged. And their pH is often normal, sometimes because they've adapted to it, but oftentimes just because they're compensating respiratory-wise. And you go, well, I don't really want them to keep compensating like that for all this long. And so we use a lot of oral bicarb, and just put them on. I usually will start with like some like 1300 TID or something like that. I have a attending who will give almost 4 grams, 4 times a day, which is kind of a lot, I think, but, you know,
because you have to be somewhat stable to go this way. You have to be able to eat and stuff.
Right.
And it's not a quick effect,
so,
but you avoid giving fluids, right?
Right.
So if your goal is just bicarb.
So if you're stable and you just want to correct things, I think that's the way to go. So I think we'll do a bicarb drip. I'll do that usually when I've got somebody who is, they're having other problems as a result, right? So maybe I'm really worried that they are not able to compensate, or they're not, they've documented they can't compensate respiratorily. And so their pH is off and they're not breathing well, and I'm probably going to end up putting them on the vent. And that's just going to make things worse, because I certainly can't keep up with, you know, if you have to have a respiratory rate that's sort of at the extremes to compensate, that's difficult to do. And so if you need to kind of correct things more quickly, a bicarb drip is probably a good idea. A lot of these people are on dialysis, though, so renal can just kind of fix it with the big green machine. So,
bicarb is, you know, another area of controversy, but I think a lot of it, what it comes down to, is what are you treating? Certainly, putting bicarb into the body via a fluid will generally increase their serum bicarb and raise their pH. So then it's like, do you need that? If you're treating, you know, the classic example, it would be like severe lactic acidosis and a patient dying of shock. Is that good? I don't know. Most people would probably give some bicarb at some pH, but probably what's killing them is the underlying illness and not their acidosis. But you know, it does have that physiologic effect. So, you know, like in the renal patient, as you describe, yeah, it maybe makes sense to get some in there. I do think it's generally more physiologic to give bicarb in a drip rather than super fast boluses, like pushing amps of it, which, you know, is probably the least physiologic way. It's this huge sudden rush. A lot of it turns into CO2 and goes intracellular and things like that. So in general, I think that's more reasonable. Just bear in mind that there's kind of a reasonable limit on how fast you can give it, because, you know, a common thing will be 150 MEQs of bicarb. That's like 3 amps in a liter of something like D5W. It makes it isotonic. Okay. But then how fast, like if, let's say you think the patient needs about an amp an hour. Well, then you can, you have to give that at what? 50 C's noise. So it's a liter, you got 150 in there. You got to give like 330 CCs an hour.
Yeah.
That's our, that's a lot of fluid already. If you need more than that. So then it's like, well, can I give more? Usually a lot of pharmacies don't like making hypertonic sorts of bicarb solutions at higher rates than that. So you end up with this volume issue again, like how much volume do I want to give versus how much bicarb? So just kind of, you know, bear these things in mind. Most people, you know, fluids with bicarb is not really a long-term necessary thing. You know, they get more stable, like you said, maybe something oral or the disease gets better. In the short term, you know, normal stuff like buffered fluids, like LR is often a totally rational thing. This is outside niche circumstances like tox cases that need bicarb and stuff
right,
like that.
Right, right. Well, and I think the thing to remember with any acid-based disturbance too is the pH normal. If the pH is normal and they otherwise look okay, I don't know that you need to correct stuff, right? Like I said, if their pH is only normal because they are breathing at the extremes of, you know, human physiology, then you need to do something. But if they're breathing relatively normal and their pH is normal and their bicarb is 12, 14, then I don't know that you need to worry about it. I think you can just kind of watch things. And I think this is a big shift that I've seen over my career. I feel like when I was in bedside nurse, I gave bicarb a lot. You know, we pushed amps of bicarb constantly on people. People were always on bicarb drips. And the only caveat I remember back then was we probably shouldn't push bicarb unless their pH is below 7.2. But we did.
Yeah, I mean, this is in that realm of like, it clearly does something. Many patients who are dying are acidotic and bicarb will make them less so. So it's hard to not do that.
Yeah.
But then the thoughtful person says, well, did we stop them from dying or did we just make them die with a more normal pH? And
right.
Many
right.
times it's the latter.
Yeah.
The other thing that we probably should have touched on is, you know, tonicity. And you mentioned a little bit, we often like normal saline for some of the neuro patients. You know, the idea being that a lot of them have some cerebral edema. You're trying to limit how much stuff is in their head. And, LR is a little bit hypotonic, meaning that you will tend to have some shift of fluid from the vascular space into tissue, and that could worsen edema, whereas saline is not. It's actually a touch hypertonic. So that's kind of a standard neurocritical care move, and, you know, almost an easy error to make, given these people like boluses of something like LR. Certainly, I wouldn't sweat it too much. You know, if you accidentally gave that person, it's not that hypotonic. It's just a touch. But this is in the realm of like, well, we don't want to kind of do anything that could be a problem. But, you know, maybe more important would be, don't be giving that patient boluses of like D5W, something severely hypotonic, which would be a much more severe osmotic shift.
Right. And we run into that occasionally in the neuro ICU. You have somebody who's persistently hypoglycemic. And the idea, the sort of the knee-jerk reaction would be to say, well, let's put them on some D5 or D10. And man, you really don't want to do that because you're going to cause all sorts of fluid shifts in the brain.
Because those are in water usually.
D5W, yeah, because it's usually D5W, D10W. And so it's very, very hypotonic. And you just don't want to do that. I'll also say that I think it's important to acknowledge that the data on hypertonic saline for cerebral edema is not great. You know, in fact, there's lots of data out there that shows that like maintaining a hypertonic, like we used to maintain everybody in at 140, 145, 150, 160, is probably not helpful. The data also is that it probably doesn't hurt. It probably just doesn't help. And so we've sort of backed off of that, but I know there are places who will still do that. They'll just say everybody just needs to be 145, 150. And so we'll intentionally drive them up. But certainly the data for as a rescue strategy is good. You know, if you have a patient who has an ICP crisis, they're having a intracranial hypertension episode, a bolus of hypertonic will help that. But also probably less so if, you know, if you're maintaining somebody at 150, 155, it's going to be really hard to get that gradient up to a level that's going to work.
Yeah, it's relative. They equilibrate to where they're at. But suffice to say that if your, you know, neuro patient is running a little hypernatremic from what you'd like, probably correcting enterally with like free water in their gut is usually, I mean, of course, it ultimately gets into their body, but much more slowly in a steady state rather than a big sudden rush. And I guess the other thing I'll just mention is that people will say things like, well, you know, picking your fluids, you know, there's more sodium in normal saline, and this patient's sodium is a little low, so maybe that's the fluid I'll select. And I mean, that's not wrong. But if you understand like anything about sodium physiology, sodium's being high or low is almost never, unless you're the guy who drank a gallon of soy sauce in 20 minutes, because you have not enough sodium. You know, it's a water balance issue. So it probably really doesn't matter. You know, that you manipulate sodium in other ways, not because, you know, their sodium is 130 and your bag of normal saline has a sodium of 152 or whatever. If you truly need to drive them up, you need to give them really a high concentration like hypertonic, or do things like manipulate how much sodium is coming out of them and so on. So, you know, you have like the SIDH patient or something. Mm-hmm. You're like, well, a little bit. Okay, listen, you're sort of like, you're, this is in the realm again of entertaining yourself with like the quarter of a 1% effect on what's going on, probably, whereas the patient probably doesn't care.
Yeah, and I think it's important again to treat the patient, right? So if you have somebody who's hyponatremic, like you said, they're 130. I've had patients that are in the 120s, and they're perfectly fine, right? They have no deficits whatsoever. Now, this is not a brain injury patient. These are typically the liver patients, right, that come in kind of chronically hyponatremic. I don't really need to sweat giving them boluses of hypertonic to get that sodium up to a quote normal level. And same thing with hypernatremia, right? I have patients all the time, you know, like kidney patients, right, who will be 150, 155, but will be perfectly normal. Should we try to normalize it? Sure, but I'm not going to like freak out about it.
Right. Yeah, and you know, the patient who is running hypernatremic and you want to get them down, whether, if it's not a neuro patient, whether you want to give them water intravenously or enterally is a more reasonable question then. But, you know, in general, use the gut if you can, right? Yeah. Now, that patient's NPO, okay. You know, you put them on some D5W or, you know, quote, bolus it. We don't usually like truly bolus D5W. It's a lot of dextrose and stuff, but you can kind of, you know, do that slow bolus. You give them like a liter,
give them a bag over
8 hours or 12 hours, put an end time on it, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That'd be sort of a surrogate for just putting water into their gut as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what else should we say about fluids?
I guess the only other thing to really touch on is how do you decide if they need fluids? You know, we've sort of been talking about giving people fluids, but we haven't really talked about how you decide to do fluids versus something else. So what's your kind of go-to? If you got a patient, the nurse calls and says, Mr. Johnson's urine output is down, or he's hypotensive, or both. How do you decide if you want to start with a bolus?
I think that, and this is, I think, become actually more true over time. Initially, people really want to turn to the magic tool or data point that will answer the question, and there isn't really one that works. And so what I have found increasingly I turn to is the opposite, which is thinking and or what you could call guessing. Ask yourself, just if I knew nothing else, you know, I didn't collect any more data, what would my guess be for whether this patient needs or will benefit from fluids? And based on their disease process and what's been going on with them, what you already know about them, you can often get pretty close. Is this that DKA patient who many of them are dry? Is this the MICU patient who's been here for 12 days and has had some renal failure and stuff? And most of them have a lot of fluid in them and they're probably not going to need a whole lot more. Mm-hmm. And so with that kind of approach and, you know, a moment of thought, taking a look at their chart, you can usually get 80% of the way there. And then again, in the theme of like, don't worry too much about like tiny fine tuning things. If you can get close enough by quote guessing or gestalt, then you can't go too wrong because you can get away from the extremes, right? Like we should definitely not give this patient fluid, or this patient has every reason to need fluid. We should definitely get, once you get away from those things, then it probably doesn't matter all that much. So, you know, giving a smallish test in C is often reasonable. Just watching is often reasonable. Yes, I'll use ultrasound and things. But even then, you know, I don't always leave the room with much more data than I had going in. Yeah, I'm looking for extremes that surprise me. I look at the heart, the IVC. I'm like, wow, they really seem hypovolemic. I'm surprised by that. Or they really seem overloaded. But most of the time, they're still in that middle ground where it's kind of... And on the one hand, that could you could take that to mean, well, I'm not really sure. But on the other hand, you could say, well, it doesn't matter so much. They're in that gray area where it's probably not a big deal. And as long as I don't do anything extreme, then I'm probably not wrong. I don't give them 10 liters. I don't give them like nothing when they might have needed. And as always, time tells, right? And that's why the approach of doing something and evaluating the response is, and that's, again, talking about sizes of boluses, a good reason to give more modest sizes because you can not give more. Whereas you're like, oh, give them 2 liters and I'll check back in 2 hours. Oh, they didn't need it. Well, now they have 2 extra liters on them. But, you know, you give them 500 and you can see then the worst case is you can't pull that back out of them.
Right. Yeah, I find that, when I do things like ultrasound and look at their heart, look at their IVC, look at their CVP, look at their, arterial waveform, pulse pressure variation, all these things... it more often than not just sort of tells me kind of what I think already, right? Like you said, let's get the ultrasound out. I look and I go, I mean, yeah, their heart looks like it needs some volume, right? I kind of thought that anyway. Rarely am I surprised. Sometimes I'll go, wow, the heart is definitely full. So that's not their problem, but I have an attending
more likely in a fresher patient, right? When you don't know the patient,
right?
Yet.
If you don't know
the patient
going on
you've
them.
Had for a while, you know much better. They're less likely to surprise you with anything, unless you know this patient who is stable has just sprouted a new bleed or something. You know, those are times when it's valuable to have data. But
yeah, I have an attending who said when he was in fellowship, he had an attending who, when they would talk about somebody has low urine output, what should we do? He would pull out this little like wheel, like a carnival game. And it was called the Wheel of Oliguria, and he would just spin it. And it would have, 250 bolus, 500 bolus, 40 LA6, 60 LA6. Like, and he just, and he said, his point was, it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter what we do. We might as well just spin the wheel. And I think to a large degree, he's right, right? Well, the urine output's low. What should we do? I mean, in most people, you go, well, just give them a little fluid and see if it helps. And if it doesn't help, then maybe they need LASIX.
Yeah, the urine thing I think maybe deserves a bit of attention because I think a lot of people early are really interested in that. And you'll hear from nurses, urine output's been low. And then they may be kind of caught on this dilemma. It's like, should I give them fluids? Are they hypovolemic and pre-renal? Should I diurese them? I mean, could they be the kidney's not working and they need to pee more? I think 90% of the time, it's not a useful signal. Because our patients are so complex that all those things could be true or not true.
Right. It could be all of them.
Yeah. So, I mean, start with that place of thinking about the patient. Do they have a worsening ATN and there's a good reason they could be becoming, oliguric from that? Do I already think that they're like hypovolemic or fluid overload? I mean, the fact that their urine output's now on the lowish side very rarely makes me want to do anything other than to just kind of make everyone happy to say that I give it some attention.
Right.
But it may be a signal, if that something could have changed, but that's usually a pretty slow and blunt signal. Like if they suddenly are newly in shock, their urine output dipping is probably not the first thing you'll see, right?
Right.
So, people talk about urine output as a useful marker of perfusion and stuff, and it can be. It's just that it's much more useful in patients who are less complex and like multi-system. Mm-hmm. The patient who is like, on the floor with heart failure and, they're like diuresing them and then your urine output's been low. That's sort of a little more applicable because it's like a monofactorial thing. In our world, urine is like the canary in the coal mine. Anything that happens, the urine changes. And then, what thread do you pull on?
Right. I find that urine output is more helpful when you have enough of it, right? So you have a patient whose MAP is a little on the low side and you go, well, are they making urine? Yeah. Are they mentating? Yeah. Okay. I don't care as much, right? But when their urine output is low, it's not as helpful.
Right, because there's a lot, yeah, a lot of potential.
Because there's a lot can cause urine output to be low. Not much causes urine output to be normal in the face of hypotension. Yeah,
right. Unless you like force them to pee with diuresis, but usually you can't even diurese the hypovolemic patient effectively. The kidneys are like, no thanks. But.
Yeah, I'm trying my best. All right,
maybe we'll cut that there. Hopefully this is a nice kind of general review for folks who just want to have some thought. In many ways, your approach to fluid is like, it's your approach to critical care in general. I mean, it runs through everything else we do. And you got to figure that out yourself. But as you can see, I think a lot of thoughtful critical care folks these days have moved in the direction of doing things for a reason. If things are equivocal, then maybe just don't do anything and let patients be patients and not mess with them. Realize when what you're doing, fiddling with knobs, is mostly about making yourself happy. And, you know, if you have this like bizarre, complex approach to your fluid resuscitations and maintenance that has like, you know, this concoction and then titrate to this rate and then switch to this and then add this, there's just not that many cases where any of this matters as much that, you know, small changes are likely to matter for anyone. As long as you can avoid extremes, then it's hard to go too wrong here. That's what you'll have the surgeon who likes more fluids because that tends to be more appropriate in their patients, the medical person who likes less because that tends to apply there, someone likes to add in a little dextra. You know, these are like personal preferences. It's like, what do you like to order off the menu? Probably the patients are not noticing or caring very often. All right, guys, we'll chat more next time. See you then.